This is Tony Baker, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee at the Bass Club Reunion, Cardiff, on the 11th of June 2010. Tony Baker.
Well, I'm Tony Baker, and I live in Warrington, Lancashire, Cheshire, as it is now. They moved it in 1974.
Where were you born?
I was born in Warrington.
When?
1940.
And the date?
The 19th of October. A Saturday night during an air raid, so my mother told me. Anyway, that's that part of it.
So you're going to be 70 this year?
I'm 70 in October, yes. Yeah. I feel like it, this, to be honest, now, just after this trauma that I've had, trying to find a hotel in the parking place.
Well, the good news is you haven't got to go anywhere for 3 days now.
No, we're here for good, yeah. As it were.
What was your first brush with the Antarctic? What was the first your first contact with it as a child or whatever?
Well, I used to read a lot. I was an avid reader as a child, and but I didn't read a lot of fiction. I used to read adventure stories, I suppose you'd call them, and exploration and history and that sort of thing. And I began to read lots of books about the Antarctic, Scott, and one in particular which influenced me was Kevin Walton's 2 Years in the Antarctic. And soon after that, I read Sir Vivian Fox's Crossing of Antarctica. Both of these books inspired me to go and see this place for myself, you know. Of course, I didn't have any idea of how to go about this.
You were still a child, were you?
No, by this time I was 22 or thereabouts.
What was it about Kevin Walton's book that stuck with you all those years?
I think it was the stories of the dog sledging, basically. It just seemed so tremendously exciting to drive a dog sledge in the mountains. He wrote vividly, I thought, about these things. And, well, that's all I can say, really. I found it inspiring.
So did you set out to follow in his footsteps?
Up to a point, I think, I must have done. As I say, I read The Crossing as well from Vivian Fox and many others, South and Mawson's books and so on, you know. But at this time, I didn't have any idea of me being able to do anything like this because I'd really no conception. Although I'd read the books, I'd really had no conception of FIDS. As it then was.
So what happened?
Falkland Islands Dependency Survey. But I had a feeling that somewhere or other I'd seen mention of this being an ongoing thing, the FIDS, and that it was probably still happening now. And if so, then it stood to reason that they must, from time to time, require joiners, carpenters or whatever, builders of sorts. And so I went to the reference library in Warrington and I just sat down with the librarian and explained what I was looking for. I said, I think, and I don't really know, actually, I can't tell you where this thought came from, but I had a feeling that I'd seen an advert for a radio operator for the Falkland Islands Dependencies. And so he got a load of magazines out, and I now know that they were New Scientist magazines. At that time I didn't. But we spent some time, the pair of us, looking through these magazines, and we found an advertisement for, I think it was an electrician. So I just took the details down and wrote off to FIDS, offering my services.
The year was?
That was in 1962. And it really shows you my naivety, because at that time it was towards the back end of the year when I wrote about this, and got a reply back quite soon, saying that they did have positions, but not at that time, because the new Finns were actually on their way south. Everything had been done earlier on in the year, you see, which had passed over me. I hadn't realised that. So they said, if you're still interested next year, write again. Next summer, it'd be the summer of 63. So this was exciting to me, and I couldn't wait for the following year. And I think I wrote in the early spring to offer my services once more, like, you know. And on that occasion, I was rewarded with an interview. Go down to Gillingham Street, I think, in those days. And I was interviewed by Bill Sloman, Johnny Green, and there was one other whose name escapes me now. But the three, anyway. And they, of course, interviewed me at length and eventually offered me a job there, and then sent me off to, was it Stag Place, for a medical. And
Was it a difficult interview, or was it a piece of cake?
I don't think it was, actually. No, it was just like a chat. I think it was something like this. They would ask me a question and let me go on at length. They asked me what had interested me in this in the first place, and I told them the same thing that I told you. I don't think it was any deeper than that, really. They asked questions about my trade qualifications, and I had my paper qualifications with me, like, you know, so they were able to see them at the time.
Do you think they were sussing you out psychologically?
Well, I didn't at the time. I didn't think anything of it, really, but I suppose they must have been, up to a point. I don't see how else they could have chosen someone for such a posting, really. So I suppose they were doing.
Who did he have to tell that you were going to go to the Antarctic?
Who did I have to tell? Mm. Well, my mother and father, of course. I still lived at home at that time. And mother was extremely upset. Because I one's dead now, but I had, at that time, three brothers. And the two elder ones were both tradesmen, an electrician and a sheet metal worker. And when they reached the age of 21, they were immediately drafted into national service and away for 2 years, one in East Africa and the other one was at Suez, in the Suez crisis. And then in 1960, the Conservative government stopped national service, and my mother was overjoyed, because I wouldn't have to go. I missed it by 12 months. So that was marvellous. And then I turned up on the door and said, I'm going to the Antarctic for 2 years. She couldn't cope with that, really. She was very upset over it. I suppose she got used to it as time went by, you know. And eventually they sailed down to... They drove me down to Southampton to get the ship. But it was a bad time for her to lose me, because she'd built up her hopes and so on that I wasn't going to go into national service. And then all of a sudden I told her something even worse.
How well prepared do you think you were when you got on board that ship?
Well, obviously it was I was a little apprehensive. Who wouldn't be, you know, because you believe in home and your friends and so on, and for the unknown. But I don't think I was daunted by it. I think I was looking forward to it. I actually fancied myself as a bit of a sailor. So I was looking forward to the sea voyage, because we used to go My dad used to take us on to the Isle of Man ferry, or on the in those days they used to have a sail in from Liverpool to Llandudno. So we often used to go on that, and it was wonderful. I used to enjoy that. I thought I'm a good sailor. I won't be seasick or anything like that. But I found things slightly differently. Although I was only sick once, and that was because somebody else was sick, and they were sitting close to me, and the smell of it all and so on, that affected me somewhat, and so I felt sick. But I actually say, I never really felt at ease on the boats going south. I always felt a little bit queasy. I didn't drink much on board because of the way I felt, and I spent quite a lot of time in bed. I didn't really. Having thought I would be a good sailor, it turned out that I wasn't the best sailor.
About being trained for Antarctic conditions, have you had lots of training, crevasse rescue?
None whatsoever.
Nothing at all?
No, none whatsoever. Prior to sailing, the only thing that I'd done was to attend the Cambridge conference and meet the other FIDs that were going down, and all the old people, of course, everybody that was there. And I found that extremely interesting to hear the talks that were given about what we were going to be doing down there.
Were they all like you? Young lads?
Oh, they were all young lads, yes. Most of them, I suppose, well, 50-50, I would say, were university graduates or undergraduates. And the rest of them were engineers or people like myself. Oh, doggy men and climbers and that sort of thing, you know.
So did you have any idea where you were being sent?
Yes. I think I was told, I'm almost certain that I was told at the Cambridge conference that I would be going to Halley Bay. And that interested me.
Did it mean anything to you?
Yes, it did, because I'd seen the photographs of Halley Bay, of the cliffs at Halley Bay, and of the base, the old base, which IGY had erected. These were in Vivian Fuchs's book. So, yes, I felt that I was going to somewhere that I almost knew, and I was certainly looking forward to going there and arriving there. I didn't really know, though, what I was letting myself in for, because it was only when things started to come along and that I was employed as a builder, and it suddenly dawned on me, I suppose, that I was going down there to build, and I wasn't going down there to drive a dog team or to climb mountains and such like. So I suppose that was a little bit of a dampener on my spirits somewhat to think that. However, as it transpired, things totally turned round.
How do you mean?
Well, I went down initially as the sole builder in inverted commas. I went down as the sole builder to erect a new office block, which was quite a large building, and it was to house a radio office, a meteorological office, a surveying office, a doctor's surgery, and a glaciological office. And initially, everybody, all the spare hands when we first arrived there after the ship had departed, all the spare hands helped me to get the fabrication up, you know, the steelwork and the outer covering of the hut, which was all prefabricated panels. It wasn't the old tongue and groove business. So it went up fairly quickly. And once it was airtight or weatherproofed, it was then up to me to continue basically on my own. But if I needed a lift, other people would come in and help me, so on. So this went throughout the winter months, me working on this and finishing off the inside of the building. I have to say at this point that a lot of the work was done by individuals who just wanted... they were amateur or DIY enthusiasts. So Gordon Bowder, the doctor, and Dudley Jahan, who were good friends, they fitted out the doctor's surgery. And they did that. Oh, and they also put the flooring down in the loft from end to end. Mm. That was it. And I tackled all the rest of it, basically. The meteorological office, the survey office, the radio shack. And then at either end, at the Met end and at the radio shack end, I had to cut a hole in the wall, which gave access to a hatch and a tower, which went up to ground level, above ground level, eventually. Of course, initially it was at roof level. And this was for the entry of the aerial feeders and for the Met men to go up and observe the... it was the Aurora man who used to go up there and take photographs. He had an all-sky camera up there, and he used to go up there and observe the Aurora.
So was the whole base underground at that point?
Apart from this building, which I'd just put up, everything else was underground, yes. And it wasn't long before this one was being buried also.
So were you taking that into account when you were building it?
No, it was built on a floor like this, really, on the snow. And we started by levelling it, first of all, and then we put expanded metal down on it. This was... I think it started out as perforated metal sheets, and then they'd got this big machine which had pulled it from one end to the other like that. And as it pulled it apart, it opened these into diamond shapes, these perforations, you see. And that was put down, and then that was over the whole area. And then at the ends, at the sides rather, running along underneath where the vertical stanchions of the building came down to the ground, we put corrugated iron sheets to provide extra support so that they didn't press down into the snow. And it was thought that that would prevent a lot of damage being done, but it really didn't. It may have extended the life of the building by a very short time indeed, not long. This went through to sometime in the August of 1964, and the building was basically up and running with still work to do, but work that could be done by other people.
You were working at ridiculously low temperatures, weren't you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I made a note about that on one occasion. As a joiner, if you're doing a lot of nailing, small panel pins and that type of thing, which is exactly what I was doing with nailing the ceiling up, you used to take a handful of panel pins and put them in your mouth to hold them, and then you'd take them out like that and bang, 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 and they'd be into the ceiling. And I did it without thinking. Of course, they all immediately froze to my tongue and to my lips, and they bled when I pulled them off. Because it was, at times, it was about minus 49 while this was going on. Now, that was fine as long as you were indoors, unheated. But it was all right because you were out of the wind, and so it was the wind that kills. The temperatures you can cope with fairly well.
But does wood perform differently at minus 49 degrees?
I don't think so, really, to be honest.
It doesn't get harder?
No, I never really felt that.
Okay.
But I do remember them nails sticking to my mouth. I only did it once.
Was there any scope for creativity and artistry, or was it very much just rudimentary carpentry work?
No. Well, it was basic carpentry work, but it was really up to the individual whether they wanted to be more artistic in things that they were doing. No, not a lot, really.
I suppose you couldn't nip out and buy a nice piece of mahogany, could you, really?
No, but there was... at the end of the year, when you made out what they call the indents, this would be requesting supplies for next year. You could request a piece of mahogany if you had reason to do so, like, you know. And it would be, within reason, I suppose, it would be supplied for you to use. In fact, I don't know where we got it from, really, but I did manage to get a piece of mahogany from somewhere. And I cut two shields out of this mahogany, one for me and one for an artistic chap, Jeremy Wright. And he painted them with the coat of arms of the Falkland Islands Dependencies Survey. And he painted them on and then varnished them, like, you know. So, and he had one, and I've got one. Still have that at home.
When you were doing your work, I mean, the client in England would be looking down over your shoulder all the time, making sure you did it to the best of your ability and produce a nice piece of work for them to live with.
Yes.
In the Antarctic, I guess there was nobody looking over your shoulder.
No.
There were rough and ready chaps. Did you find you were cutting corners and reducing your standards at all?
I'm not sure. I suppose inevitably you would do, because things had to be done fairly quickly.
And you had limited resources.
And we had limited resources. So I suppose they did err a little on the rough and ready side, but I didn't really notice it that much, to be honest. It was... No, I mean, in a few years later, 2 years later, I went down for the rebuilding of Halley Bay, the complete base, and that was in 1967. There was one of a number of joiners and builders on that job, because it was a very big job. Seven complete new huts.
Is this Grillage Village?
Grillage Village, yes. Mm. But myself and Dave Hill, another joiner, we were tasked with fitting out the lounge building. So we worked quite precisely to that. We made as posh a job as we could of it, you know. Dave did the bar, and I did some special lighting which ran around the joint, like a cornice. It was fluorescent tubes, but they were inside a housing with a plastic cover of some sort, like a translucent glazing. That was another part that I did. And I also worked on the bench seating around the walls, and we upholstered them in, I can't remember, it must have been some kind of leatherette, I think, at that time. So, yes, we worked nicely on that, and we made as professional a job as we could on it. But if you were working on the garage door...
Which you did.
Which I did, yes. It wouldn't be as important.
You had problems with that, didn't you?
Ah, well, now, then, I'm not sure which one you mean here.
Well, you tell me.
The original garage and generator shed were built back-to-back with one another, and by the time I'd gone down there, they were bedded. And the only way into them... there was a roof, a hatch to go down a ladder, but the only way into it for vehicle traffic or for the drums of fuel was down a long slope. And at the top of the slope, I made a drawbridge door which lay flat on the surface of the snow, and it had canvas around the edges of it that you could stretch out onto the snow surface and cover with rough snow. And that made a very good door, because the snow normally blew over the top of it. That was fine. It was a huge door. It was as big as this room is, in square area, you know. And it had a big tripod thing with a handle, and you turn the handle to lift the door up, and it wasn't hinged. It was just there was a stake at the back to stop it from sliding back, and it just lifted up, and you could drive in, you could drive out, and then you'd lower it down when you'd finished doing what you were doing. However, I think probably the door that you're the garage door that you're remembering was on Grillage Village, and we, before we went south on this occasion, we were taken, that four or five of us builders were taken to Ipswich. Now, I'm not sure of the name of the company, but I think it might have been Bolton and Paul who made these buildings, and we went to see them. They were going to erect a part of one to show us how it was done. So it so happened that they erected the garage, or one end of the garage, which to show us this door that was supplied. It was a roller door. I'm not sure it was a roller door or whether it folded, I can't remember. But anyway, a lovely door. But it wasn't tall enough. And I said to Derek Gipps, who was the man at the time, I think he was in charge of procurement or something, and I said, the kegs won't go in there. They won't fit down through that doorway. Of course they will. I said, they won't. Oh, yes, they will. And I said, well, you mark my words. And, of course, they didn't. Because the kegs that, original musk kegs that were supplied, were like a little, the original VW Beetle car, the little round top thing. But the kegs that we had at that time at Halley Bay, with the same basic machine, but that little round top cabin had been removed, and they'd put a big square box on top with bunks in. And it stood about 4 foot taller than the others, and they wouldn't go in, you see. So anyway, when it all came to be finished and it was all up and running in Halley Bay, Derek Gipps came down to have a look at it all, and I was really very pleased to say to him, come and look at this. I told you it wouldn't bloody fit. And of course it wouldn't fit, but he was a bit embarrassed by it, I think. He didn't say anything to me. He walked off in a bit of a huff.
Did you extend it to make it fit?
Well, I had to make... We fitted it to the top as high as it would go, as high as we required it, and it came down to about 4 foot above the ground level. So we had to make I made a great big panel, which you had to lift in and out and fit underneath it, and then lower the door down on top of it. It worked fine, actually. It worked okay once it was done, but it was just I was just so annoyed because they wouldn't take my advice, and I'd been there for 2 years and I knew exactly what was required, but they don't ask.
Can you think of examples where the skills you acquired whilst you were still here came in really handy in the Antarctic, or were you having to learn new skills because of the conditions you were working in?
You mean trade skills?
Yeah, carpentry.
Carpentry skills. No, I think.
It was transferable.
Transferable, yeah. It's pretty much the same. Where I served my time in a chemical company as a carpenter, as a joiner, actually.
Before or after?
No, before I went to the... Right. As a 15-year-old, I went to work for a Unilever company, mm-hmm. In Warrington, and I served my 6 years apprenticeship there. Now, that was totally different training to what I would have had if I'd gone to work for a building company. A lot of it was posher work, if you had more high class work, mm-hmm. because we worked in the offices and things like that. We used mahogany and we used oak and that sort of thing. I couldn't have put a roof on me on a house for the love of Mike. because I'd studied these things at school at day release, but I'd never worked on one, and I'd have found it very difficult to put my hand to that.
But you had to do it.
No, I didn't have to do it because I never worked in the building trade.
I mean, in the Antarctic. Yeah.
No, in the Antarctic, I didn't, because it was a different kind of building there. Right. They were all steel framed buildings with covered in panels. You didn't have to build a traditional roof with roof spars and rafters and things like that.
So how do you put up buildings in the UK that resembled those you had to make in the Antarctic, or was that new?
Well, no, not really, no.
So you were learning a bit?
I was learning a little bit on that, yeah. But it wasn't...
nothing special.
It wasn't a very big learning curve on that.
Okay. Yeah.
To do that. All the steelwork had been sent down. It was cut and drilled, and it was just a matter of bolting things together.
Meccano, was it?
Meccano, yes.
Before we move on to other things, is there anything else about your professional work down there you wanted to talk about? Any great achievements or embarrassing disasters?
I don't really think so, to be honest, no.
Okay. When it came to Grillage Village here in 67, you must have got to know Big Al Smith, did you?
Oh, yes, I was on with Bill, with Big Al, Jim Shirtcliffe, Fanny Hill. John Goldsworthy. Mm-hmm. They were all people that was on my year there.
What was that year like? Because that must have been a huge explosion in activity, mustn't it?
It was. It was the biggest year. I don't know if they've... Well, they've had bigger years since. But up until that point, it was the biggest year that had ever been in British Antarctic Survey history. We had two bases, the old one, and about a mile and a half away, the new one, Grillage Village. And memory fades, actually. And I'm not sure whether we had 50 people at one time at Grillage Village, plus the people that were down at the old base. So it'd be something like 70 people altogether in Halley Bay.
And were you building Grillage Village in the summer or in the winter down there?
Well, it started in the summer. The ship unloaded. We worked 12-hour shifts right around the clock for about, I can't remember really, it was about 2 weeks, I think, the ship was in. It may have been 3 weeks because they overstayed to give us a lift so that we'd have this extra labour. Because once they started getting stuff ashore, we started to erect it,
yeah.
You see. So, but this was in the high summer. Eventually it became winter, of course, and then it went through the winter. But by that time the ship had returned and we were locked up at Grillage Village, the 50 of us. And it worked very well, I think. We had a good time up there, actually. Everybody was fitted in.
So you had got them. You got the structure up before the winter struck.
Oh, the structure was up. It was covered and weatherproofed, and it was then down to just fitting the buildings out inside. Making initially we lived in the roof of one of the buildings over the kitchen, and just in sleeping bags on the loft floor, with lilos, you know, for comfort. So then we had to build the bunks in the bunk room building and the bathrooms, showers and so on, you know. We had to fit out the garage and this infamous door. there were seven buildings, actually. There was a general, but there was the kitchen, and it was so that the kitchen was at one end of the building, and then it was a kind of a general area and dining room, and then across the road, a little passageway to the lounge, and then along from that in this direction, there was the bunk rooms, one building there of bunk rooms, and I think that. Yeah, I think it was two buildings of bunk rooms either side of this central corridor.
So there you were, working through the winter with no daylight to speak of.
No, none whatsoever.
With 50 guys, did you think those 50 guys got on really well? Better than a British building site?
Well, I think they did. As I've already pointed out here, I've never worked on a building site because I didn't work in the building trade in this country. But I think we must have done, actually, yes. I think we got along very well together.
And was that because there was no alternative? You were all shacked up together, literally?
Possibly that was something to do with it. But I just felt that everybody was a nice guy, basically. They were all pretty good guys.
What do you make of Big Al?
Oh, Al, I love the guy. And his knowledge of building, of all sorts of building. Every trade in the building sphere is immense. I like Alan, he's a good mate. I got on very well with him.
Did it go, apart from the famous garage door, did it go smooth?
I think it did, yes.
There ought to be a blue plaque on that garage door, shouldn't there?
There should, actually, yes. I think it went down well, to be honest. Everything went swimmingly. We kept one hut. I can't remember which one it was now. But what one hut was we didn't work in it until after the midwinter, because we built a stage at one end and we had a review. That was good fun. There were several of us. I was involved in it, and there was quite a few other people involved. I wasn't one of the major participants.
What do you remember about it? What sort of sketches and scenes?
Oh, well, there was all sorts of sketches. I can't really remember. I suppose the one that I do remember is the one that I featured most prominently in. When I was sitting on a stool on the stage with a bucket in front of me and supposedly peeling spuds and complaining about my job to anybody that would listen to me. And I'm peeling these spuds and throwing them into the bucket and the water, and making an effort to... The water splashing out, and, you know, everyone that goes in went in with feeling. It was a running joke. Went on through quite a few of the different sketches that were going on around me. To finish with me losing my rag with all this. And I picked the bucket up. Of course, it had been swapped. And I picked the bucket up and I threw it into the audience with all... But it just had torn paper or something in it. So that's the thing that I find most memorable, because I was involved in it. Mm. The other things, I'm not too sure now.
Was there never friction in those winters in Halley? Did you never get to situations where people lost their rag slightly? Or?
There was, actually, yes. But that was in my second year.
That would be in
65. we did have an undercurrent of discontent, I suppose. I don't know really where it came from, truthfully, but we seemed to split up into them and us, and there was quite a lot of us who used to meet. We were the rebels, I suppose. We would meet late at night in the kitchen, complaining about everything, and you'd have the others, the goodies, who'd all be in bed by that time. I don't know. Do you know? I really don't know even till today what started all that. But it never developed into anything, any fighting or anything like that.
So who or what were you rebelling against?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Was this a survival?
I think it. No. I think it probably started, actually. It probably all started before I arrived back on base. I've not told you yet. I mentioned it earlier on, the fact that I alluded to the fact that I'd gone out with a dog team.
You're sort of going to come to that, yeah.
Well, we'd need to sort of jump back to it. when I came back from 7 months in the field, the survey had sent down a new balloon shed. And like always, it arrived, almost always, these things arrived on base with something short, something missing. And on this occasion, they'd sent all the parts down and the nuts and bolts and so on, but no drawings showing you how to erect it. And when I arrived back on base from the field, Rod Rees-Jones, who was the new surveyor just come in at that time, he'd either taken charge or he'd been given charge of starting to erect this building. And he did a wonderful job, because every day he had a radio sked with Stanley, and he spoke to Clem, who was in Stanley office, Clemenson, known as Clem. And Clem had the drawings in the Stanley office, and he'd have a drawing in front of him, and he'd say to Rod over the radio, imagine a square X feet by X feet, a rectangle, and in this corner that you draw this for so many squares on a graph paper type of thing, you know. And he went through these drawings on a daily basis, giving him just enough to go out and start and do and put a bit more together. And it went on like this for weeks, until eventually it was built correctly and it was up and running. But because of the way it was built, it was actually built 90 degrees wrong, out with the way the wind blows. So there's a on the traditional balloon shed in those days, we used to blow a balloon up with hydrogen gas inside this thing. And then there's a big door at the side which you can open, and you walk out with this balloon, which was quite large. And there's a radio sonde and a radar target and so on hanging on a long string behind it. And you'd clear the building and then let it go. Well, after 12 months, you couldn't do that because this door in the side of the building was snowed up. So then you had to resort to the roof. And the roof was built to open up. But because it had been built 90 degrees wrong, the wind would tend to catch the balloon as it came out and blow it into the open doors and burst it. If it had been built 90 degrees the other way, it wouldn't have had the same effect. Nevertheless, it was I mean, once I got back on base, I didn't take charge, actually, because he was already au fait with what was going on. I just did what he told me, basically, did this. And, of course, I had my input as well. But I don't think that goes like that, because it's you know, traditionally it wouldn't be done that way. So we got this thing up. But I think that this undercurrent stems from that. People were disgruntled. And then with the next year's field programme was upsetting folk. It wasn't proposed to do what those on base felt should be done. They were directed in different directions.
Because?
I don't know why, to be honest. I couldn't tell you the reasons for this, but these directions came from head office. So it upset people, and I think that's where that was my understanding of it anyway. Right. I never went into anything really very deeply. I sort of tried to keep myself to myself in those things. But I was a member of the I think they call them the Night Riders.
The Dissidents.
The Dissidents, yes. We used to gather in the kitchen, and I'd make a big pan of curry, and everybody had took into this curry and drink. If there was any beer knocking around, they'd drink beer, otherwise it'd be coffee.
let's move into the field, because part of the attraction for going to the Antarctic for you was to do some field work with dogs.
Absolutely.
And you did.
And I was very, very fortunate that I did, yes. And I didn't think that I would having got the position and gone down there and realised what I was doing, all of a sudden I thought, well, that's me out of the field activities.
So what happened?
Well, in the August, the base leader, the new base leader of 1964, who was Dudley Jahan, came to me and asked me if I'd like to go into the field. That there was a position because everybody else was tied up with their own programmes and they needed a man to go into the field. Would I like to do that? And I snatched his hand off, of course. So that's how I came to go into the field. And we had... When we left base on September the 10th, I think, 1964, to sledge the 340 miles to Pyramid Rocks, which was the main depot in the Totten Fjella, Totten Mountains. And we had three muskegs and three dog teams travelling together. But because it was so early in the season and we were travelling due east and the wind blew incessantly from the east right into our faces, so it wasn't long before we devised a method which allowed us to do this a little bit easier, because the dogs didn't like it. They were difficult to control. And so we rigged up a system which, in retrospect, may have been a mistake, but it certainly made it easier for us to move, because we could move in weather conditions which we could possibly not have moved in had we just been driving the dogs on their own. And what happened was these muskegs were pulling two or three sledges depending on the weight of the sledges, and they were normally close coupled together, but what we did was to uncouple two. And there'd be a sledge at the front, and then we strung a wire hawser from the rear of that front sledge to the front of the rear two sledges, some distance behind, and between the two, we put the dog teams just walking alongside this wire hawser. They were fixed to it, clipped to it, but you never travel more than 1 or 1.5 miles an hour. So it was quite within the dog's capabilities. And in fact, if the muskeg had to stop for whatever reason, the dogs used to keep on walking and they'd pull these two sledges. Of course, they were moving to start with, but they'd pull these two sledges along behind them until they were forced to stop by reaching the forward sledge, you know. And that enabled us to have one... We had two men to each dog team. Normally, they would travel together, one either side of the sledge. And this enabled us to... One driver to travel for an hour in the cab of the muskeg, and the other driver would sit on top of the front sledge with his face in the dog team behind, and he'd keep an eye open for problems. He could jump on and off easily and attend to it while still moving, and then get back onto his sledge. And it was wonderful. You had your back to the wind, smashing. It did lead to further problems later on the next year, actually. But that was good, that. We got to these mountains eventually, the three muskegs and the three dog teams, and then we split up. The muskegs were just delivering stores along the route, petrol dumps, and in the mountains, food and fuel for ourselves to work. And then the dog team split up then and went off to do the survey and the geology work. And we spent some weeks doing that until eventually the people, Mill Samuel and Dick Worsfold, that was Mill Samuel, a surveyor, Dick Worsfold, a geologist. They had to come back to base to get the ship back to UK. They'd done their 2 years. And also, Phil Cotton, who had been appointed the new base leader, for the following year, also had to come back to take over the new the base after the ship had gone. So that left just four of us in the mountains, two teams and four men. The surveyor, Di Wild, Louis Jukes, geologist, Simon Russell, the radio operator, and myself. And we then spent the next 5 months or so swapping over. We'd do a couple of months with one man and then swap and do a couple of months with the other fella, you know. And we spent the whole of the summer then traversing these ranges back and forth, doing survey and doing geology.
How was it for you in the field?
Well, it was terrible initially because it really was my low point, or one of my very lowest points, because we set out first of all from the base driving the dog teams, and eventually we had to give up because of the way these things were, you know, we couldn't travel in the weather. But and to a lesser extent, Di Wild, who were driving this new dog team, which I'd picked up from Hope Bay originally. They were transferred in from Hope Bay to Halley Bay, and Simon Russell and myself were on the Shackleton, and we picked them up there and we took them down to Halley Bay, and I thought that was the end of my attachment to the dogs, but I got stuck with them again, and I just couldn't drive these dogs. It was the same as everything else. We never got much training in these things on base. People didn't take you out and show you the ropes. My initial training in dog driving and camping techniques was one night before we set sail on the major journey. And with Di Wild, who was a fresher, the same as I was, and we were given this dog team, the Beatles, and they said, well, go out for a few miles and drive around, camp for the night and come back tomorrow. And that was it. And then on this journey, I just couldn't get the dogs to run. They would not go forward. It reduced me to literally to tears. I wept. I thought, how am I going to cope with the next 6 months of this? It was an awful feeling, and I was very, very low with it. Very, very low. And eventually, we adopted this different technique of travel, and we got to the mountains, and I moved then over to a different dog team with an experienced sledger, and I found that fine. And we did that for a few weeks, and then I swapped back to the Beatles, as we'd call this dog team, from Hope Bay. And Phil Cotton and Milne Samuel came back to base, and me and Di Wild went off into the Wild Blue Yonder to further the survey work. And these dogs, neither of us got much out of them. Di did a bit better than I did, but it was terrible. And we had to relay loads constantly, half a sledge load, and we'd managed to get them a few miles ahead and dump the load, and then we'd go back and pick the load up, and doing that constantly. And then all of a sudden, after some weeks of this, we relayed a load, dropped it off, and went back to our campsite, and it was the last of the day, so we stayed with the campsite till the following morning. And the following morning we broke camp, and they never looked back. These dogs changed literally overnight. We thought initially they were going very well. We thought, well, they're following our tracks from yesterday, so they're happy. But we got back to where we'd dumped this stuff, and we loaded it again. And off they went. Never looked back. The rest of the 7 months, or the rest of the 6 months or so that we were there in the mountains, they were the most wonderful dog team imaginable. They did everything that you could ask of them.
Is that the big psychological change for you as well? Did you start enjoying it after that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah, we did. Because it really was a worrying time up until that point, that we will not get any work done the way we were going. It was a worrying time. It must have been even far more worrying for Di, who was there from a professional point of view. I was just there for the adventure.
You know. So having wanted to go there for so many years, was it a letdown or did it exceed your expectations?
Oh, it exceeded them in every way.
How do you mean?
Well, I don't know really what I mean by that, except to say that it was marvellous. And to this day, there's rarely a day passes without I think about what a happy time it was, a wonderful time. I don't remember the bad times, but we did have them. If I stop to think about them, as I have done now, then, yeah, there were bad times. But it's like all the summers when you were a child were sunny, weren't they? You never saw the rain as a child. And I suppose it's something of that aspect. You know, you remember the good times, and the good times were many. And they really were very good times. Some of the things that we saw, you know, the landscapes and so on, you know, it was wonderful.
There's a couple of just specific points to ask you about.
Yes.
When you went down south on the Shackleton, you spent some time in Stanley, apparently, before you went on. Were you working
there? That's right, yes, I was. I did various things, actually, in Stanley. I worked in the Bass warehouse, fitting some shelves and things. But I was also, at one other period, I was designated to go with Phil Cotton, who was the surveyor. And Phil was making a town plan. So I spent some weeks, I'm not sure how long, it was quite a long time actually, that I spent with Phil walking around the town with chain measures, you know, posts and him and his tripod and his theodolite, measuring elevations and distances and so on, to making a town plan of Stanley and the environs. So that was quite an undertaking there.
And he spent some time on board Shackleton doing seismic work.
Yes.
Which came to a rather sudden end, apparently.
Well, it did. Initially, the idea of this seismic work was that we, in tandem with HMS Protector, and the Protector being a Royal Naval ship, they had charge of the explosives. And so we would sail out, and we had a hydrophone on the end of a long cable, which we were dragging behind us. And I don't know the technicalities of it all, but every so often they'd throw a charge of dynamite over the stern of the Protector and explode it. And we would record the seismograph records. And this went on for a little while until eventually they had a premature explosion on the Protector.
Actually on board?
Yes, and two of the sailors were killed. I think it was two, and some injured. And that finished their activity. They set sail immediately and went back to Stanley, I think, possibly to Montevideo, I'm not sure. But they left the area. And so they devised a scheme whereby we on the Shackleton would do both jobs. And that was damned hard work and cold and miserable. We had this long cable with the hydrophone on the end of it. And what we had to do because of circumstances, we'd let the cable out. I can't remember the... We let the cable out, and then they dropped the charge over the back and exploded it. And then we would have to pull the cable back on board. Mm-hmm. And it was several hundred feet long, this cable. Quite a heavy cable. And, of course, you were pulling the seawater in with it. you were saturated in freezing cold seawater, your gloves were sodden, and we had to walk back and to along from the stem to the stern, laying this cable out in a straight line. And I suppose they checked that the hydrophone was in order, and then we'd let it out again, and they'd throw another charge over. And that went on for several days, doing that, and it was damned hard work, that was. Bitterly cold and wet, and not very enjoyable. But I suppose it's maybe I'm wrong on this, but I always like to think that it's coming to fruition now with the oil that they're discovering in that area, because these seismic records must have shown things like that up at the time, shown whether it was worthwhile delving a little deeper into these things. And I was only told today on my way down here that they've actually announced that they've discovered oil within the last month in the Falkland Islands. That's news to me today.
What do you think was your scariest moment down south? Was there a time when you were fearing for your safety, yes, or sanity?
There was one time. I was with Louis Jukes at the time. We'd changed again, sledging companions, and Louis and I were sledging together, and we'd gone to a place called, which we called, or the Stella Nunataks. Now, I don't know, they're not called that on the maps today. It's in Norwegian territory, and they've got some Norwegian name on them. But we call them the Stella Nunataks. And we'd gone to visit these, and it started to snow very, very heavily. And we were in the lee of these Nunataks, and we were getting it deeper and deeper and deeper. And it snowed for about 10 days or more, incessantly. And when eventually it did stop snowing, we couldn't move while it was like that. We couldn't do anything. To be honest, I don't think we actually did any geology there. We never got onto a piece of rock. But it was time to come back, to return to base. So eventually, when this snow stopped falling, we broke camp to try and make our way, and we were at the bottom of this hill in the lee of these Nunataks, and the only way we could move was for one of us to walk ahead of the dogs and then walk back down next to our original track, make a double track, and then walk ahead again, making three tracks, making them as wide as you could. And we did this until you got tired, basically, and couldn't go any further. And then you'd turn round and you'd call the dogs, and the remaining man would be at the back pushing like hell on the sledge, and the dogs would go and they'd get as far as you were. And we did a mile in 8 hours, and it was back-breaking work, as you can imagine. And we decided that we'd have to wait for something, for the snow to harden up or whatever. And we were rewarded. Eventually the wind did start to blow, and it blows the snow away, basically, and what's left, it hardens into a surface that you can run on. But it was while we were down there before this actual movement began. We were waiting for the snow to ease off and to finish, and we were stuck in our tent, and we virtually ran out of paraffin. What little bit of paraffin we did have, we had to conserve for when we started to move, because we would need the paraffin then to make a hot drink and to make hot food for the journey. But while we were just lying in our tent, we starved. We'd put a cup of snow into your sleeping bag, and it would eventually melt and give you a little drop of water to drink. But even worse, we ran out of dog food completely, and we couldn't feed the dogs for a week or more. And that really was heartbreaking. To hear them crying of hunger. They wanted something, you know, to eat. and we hadn't got anything to give them. We did, in fact, give them tins of butter and stuff like that that we had. We weren't short of food. We were short of the wherewithal to cook it. But we had ample, sufficient food to give them some, but not enough to satisfy them, like, you know. And that was a low point, because it was a little worrying, wondering whether... We were 50 miles or so from our depot, and wondering whether we'd get out of it. We did, fortunately. We got out of it and we got back to the base. The other two people, Di Wild and Simon Russell, had been at the depot several days waiting for us and wondering where we were. And they were coming, were becoming a little bit worried.
It says here you were feeding the dogs their own faeces, is that right?
Yeah, there was. I didn't know whether you wanted to hear that one or not. Yes, if one of us had to go and do something, there was one dog in particular, Wilfred, this dog's name was, and he seemed to suffer from the hunger more than the others. He made certainly made more howling noises, and we'd pick it on the shovel and throw it to him, and he'd wolf it.
Your feces?
Yes, and he'd just wolf it down.
I think we have a sort of suit for food now. That's been marvellous, Tony. Thank you very much indeed.